And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay interview.
Hello, everyone. She reigned longer than any other British monarch, 71 years. Only Queen Victoria and King George III had, before her, reigned for longer. She reigned over 14 realms, sovereign states, apart from the UK, and was head of the Commonwealth. Two of those realms, other than the UK, are represented here today, Canada and Jamaica. And we'll hear from one point of view from the subcontinent. But naturally, this is a private conversation shared with you, our listeners, and my guests are speaking in a purely personal capacity. And last week, after a short illness and a very long life, she passed away and was buried, as the whole world saw, at Windsor Castle, after a solemn and unforgettable funeral ceremony at Westminster Abbey in London. Obviously, I'm referring to the late Queen Elizabeth II. Let me first of all thank Pammy and Michael Type, well known to many of our local listeners, for hosting us at their home in Gentoux in the canton of Geneva. Thanks for your hospitality, Michael and Pammy. It's very kind of you. And let me ask each of my guests sitting around Michael and Pammy's dining table to introduce themselves briefly, and then you can hear their voices. Right at the beginning, I apologize for the sound of any fumbling, but I only have two microphones for the five of us. Michael, thanks for making us welcome here at home. And just please introduce yourself briefly.
Well, most of my working life has been in radio and television, and for several years in the British Foreign Service. I started the television service in Kenya as its first director, and then in a team we started up television in Aden, Ethiopia, Mauritius, and the Sudan. And then I came to Geneva, and until my retirement, I was head of the Secretariat of the European Broadcasting Union.
Right. Thanks a lot, Michael. Sanjay, over to you.
I've been a photojournalist and a broadcaster in my career, and I came to Geneva in 2003 and working with the International Telecommunication Union, from where I retired. But before that, I'd worked in New York and Bhutan and Bangkok and other places. So it's been quite an interesting career.
So you've been around a little bit.
Yes.
Norman, over to you.
Hello. My name is Norman Williams. I'm Jamaican and a naturalized Swiss. I went to school in Montreal, Jamaica, Spain, and I've additionally lived, apart from Switzerland, lived and worked in London and in Grenoble. I'm married to an American with one child, and for most of my life I was brought up under somewhat of a British culture in Jamaica with a strong American influence and a special flavor from Canada.
Good for you. Okay, David.
Yes, thanks, Michael, and thank you to Michael and Pammy indeed for having us in our lovely home. I'm David Friedman. I'm Canadian. I've been in Switzerland for a little over 10 years. Various roles in multinationals and various marketing functions is what brought me here to Switzerland. Today, I lecture as a professor at EU Business School in my professional life, as well as consult. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to the discussion this morning.
Great. Well, David, we're going to start with you. So tell us, what did her reign mean to you? I mean, what stood out to you, if I put the question in a slightly different way, as memorable, if anything at all, to you? And could it be described as a good reign?
Sure. Speaking certainly in a personal capacity, my memory of the Queen, what stood out when the question arose, Michael, is having seen the Queen in person. She came to Toronto in 1997, and I was there amongst literally thousands of individuals who were all together in this very special moment. And I think if you ask the question, was it a good reign? The simple fact that the energy that I felt those years ago, that we saw that again. I mean, what was the number? 5 billion people were together watching the funeral of the Queen?
5 billion.
That's what I understood. I could be wrong. Please quote me otherwise. But tells me that the fact that this remains such a momentous moment, the fact that something akin, there was a poll that was done in Canada just after she passed away, almost 50% of Canadians had been planning to watch the funeral, tells you the importance and that this reign had significant meaning. And I suppose we'll talk a little bit more about how that plays out across the country.
And Sanjay, just going around the table, was it a good reign?
It certainly was. It was a very interesting reign. It was I think the Queen stood out for the fact that she held herself very well right through. There was not one bit of scandal, although she held her family together through many other ups and downs. But she herself reigned with great, she reigned as a very good Queen, I think.
Norman, it was a very simple, brief question. In your opinion, was it a good reign?
Yes, it was a good reign, but she represented for us stability, because she was Queen of Jamaica as well, like Queen of Canada. She was a grandmotherly figure. She came across as a concerned figurehead that oversaw what was happening, even if she didn't have direct power. But on the other side, it was also polemic. A lot of older Rastas, reggae people were anti-monarchists, and I have no use for that. But they didn't mind her per se. There was much sympathy for her personally, especially because in Jamaica, because of the Lord Perfumer scandal, where it was thought that a lot of the cover-up was due to Philip. So there was a lot of rallying around the Queen, because people did not like Philip. And they really liked the Queen. In fact, the Queen and Harry before marriage were the really popular one, and Princess Margaret. Jamaica loved Princess Margaret.
No, I have to ask you to clarify. Don't give the microphone away, because there'll be many people listening who do not know who John Perfumer was. What was that Perfumer scandal?
Lord Perfumer was the war minister back in the 60s. And there was a huge scandal of Russian spies in a sort of sex network that implicated government officials.
The infamous Mandy Rice Davis.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually, the procurer of these ladies was actually a Jamaican. Lucky Gordon, who went to school with my uncle. So I think the Jamaicans had an inside track, so they knew a lot of what the cover-up was, so there was a lot of sympathy for the...
I think it's time to pass the microphone to Michael Tyvee, who was ever there. So Michael, tell me, what was memorable? Because you have a long memory. I won't ask you how old you are, but I think you may even go back before the Queen's father, but to another reign. And could it be described as a good reign?
Well, in my 91 years,
yeah, 91 years.
I think it's been a very good reign. But like all people who are heads of state and queens and kings and so on, there are always ups and downs. I mean, if you think back over the years, she came to the throne when she was a very young person. But then during her time, there have been the problems in Northern Ireland. There have been family problems. But overall, she has been an iconic figure. And she is a symbol of stability during the time she has been queen. And we must also remember that that when she became queen, there was a large British empire. And in that time, it has dwindled to some of the countries which you have mentioned. But nonetheless, she's managed to keep all these plus 54 nations together. And I think the Commonwealth will still survive without being either a monarch of several of them, like Canada and Australia and New Zealand, but there will be a combine of all the ex-colonies.
Okay. So don't go too far, Michael, because you're sort of jumping into my next question, but maybe it's a bit unfair. But I'm going to come to you first on this one, David. If you had to divide her reign into segments, after all, 71 years is a long time, a very long time. What would those segments or periods of time be in your perception, and why?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly look at the period that would have led up to, at least for the Canadian context, in 1982. Why do I give that year out? Because that's the year that our constitution was repatriated back to Canada. And so that represented a continuity, I think, as Michael said, of tradition, but at the same time represented a new direction, a new definition of the role of monarchy, although not formally insofar as the monarch, that is to say the queen and now the king, of course, remains our head of state. So I think one could look at that period. I think if we then continue further, one could speak of, some degree of course, with some of the ups and downs that you had mentioned, Michael, of perhaps a lessening of interest. And it is true that in the case of Canada, the interest or the attachment to the monarchy has been on the decline. And if you look at the numbers, you see that the identification with the monarchy in Canada, and I speak generally here, is typically higher amongst an older generation than a younger. If we then talk about, let's say, you know, different eras, and we talk about, you know, let's say, BQ before Queen and post-Queen, if we talk about a new era, I think that's where things will become very interesting indeed. only because I think now, particularly with some of the views that King Charles has, and I speak here in particular regarding views about our First Nations, I think we're actually on the cusp of a very, very new relationship with the monarchy. We can maybe talk about that in a bit further.
Sanjay, we turn to you now. I mean, again, long reign. Again, I'm not going to ask you to say publicly how old you are, but there's a lot of silver hair that I can see from where I'm sitting. 71 years. Could you divide that reign into segments? And if you could, what would they be?
Well, I'm nearly 70 myself.
Okay. So, you're a young, you're a strip of a lad.
But I remember when the Queen came to India soon after her coronation, she came in 1957, and I went with my parents and my uncle and aunt to the airport to receive her. So, I mean, we had a great sense of, you know, I think the people of India at that time, despite everything that had happened earlier, despite the partition of India and so forth, we still held the Queen in some respect. And then in 1957, that's the time when she came to India. And then later on, the first Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in India, in Delhi, I did the radio commentary for that. And so that was quite something. And of course, one said very nice things about the Queen.
Of course.
So different sections through the years. For us, it was just a continuity, I think, you know, in India, because we'd gained our independence, and Nehru was also a great supporter of the Commonwealth and the Queen.
Okay.
But there were differences.
Okay. We're going to come to the Indian question a little bit later. Well, in fact, the next question. But I just want to hear what Norman has to say about the 71 years, whether, in fact, it is possible to divide them into segments. He was a young queen, and then a middle-aged queen, and then a mother queen, and a grandmother queen. What do you think? What's your perception?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would divide it into three segments, which is World War II, the Empire breakup, which when she was a fledgling monarch, and I guess there was a lot of pressure on her at the time, which she navigated well. Then it moved into more like the 60s, 70s, where it was the growth of the Commonwealth emerging from the breakup, as well as Britain's entry into the European Union, European Commission, and the IRA questions in Ireland. So that was a difficult period in itself, but she's, again, navigated that. And then I would say that the third segment was older age. And I think the defining, how should I say, characteristic of that age is managing family woes. There was the tragedy of Diana. There was scandals among the kids. Because you also have to look at the new generation coming. They don't have the same sense as she would have had of, you know, duty and circumspection, you know, especially the minor royalties. They're there to enjoy life, and sometimes it gets excessive. Right.
Okay, Sanjay, let's go back to India again, and let's go a little bit more deeply. Did, in your opinion, the young queen play a significant role in the newly independent Republic of India in the early years after her reign? I mean, she ascended the throne just 4 years after the 47 partition and creation of Pakistan. What was India's attitude towards the UK and monarchy in those early years, and how would you describe it today?
Well, I think there was not much difference. I mean, India was independent, and the UK at that point really didn't matter so much, really. And particularly the Queen. I mean, India had relationships, foreign relations with all countries, but the Queen was the government of the United Kingdom ruled in a name, but she was not as important. But Nehru was very fond of even Lord Mountbatten and Edwina, you know, when they were there and afterwards. So there was a connection that stayed on, and he made sure that India, after independence, continued to and built up relationships with the rest of the world. But the Commonwealth, which was set up and was, you know, India became a part of that, there were differences because, as Nehru said in his first interview with the BBC on television when he went for the coronation, he said, look, geography makes a difference. And the view from the Anglo-American view of Asia and India was different from the Indian point of view of, you know, how they saw it. As he said, you know, the Cold War was in progress, but India had to deal with a huge differences in geography, and China had a large border across, 2,000 kilometer border across India. So for them, the view was different, and so that, and I think that played a big role in the relationships between India and Britain at that time.
Just might be instructive, Sanjay, just briefly for people who don't know the history and the geography, just to explain what India's position was during the Cold War.
Well, so
I know that's a big question.
Yes, it's a big question. So very briefly, I think India was charting its own route and all path, and they were more aligned with the Soviet Union at that time because they realized that the British and the Americans had their own geopolitical outlook on the rest of the world. So Nehru had his vision was non-alignment, which was that he would stay away from the fray, but work in India's national interest.
Okay. We're going to make another leap of geography. That's the beauty of radio. You can really travel miles in a split second. We're going to go to Canada again, David. How is it, this is a question which I'm sure is no surprise to you, that Canada stayed loyal, I put loyal in inverted commas in my notes, to the monarch since 1867, if my history is correct. Why has it not gone the Republican route? And by the way, what actually is a dominion? It's always an interesting question, I think, because I think Jamaica is technically, or was technically, a dominion. And in such a vast and varied country, going back to Canada again, how does the far west, the vast north, view monarchy? And what about Quebec? A lot in one question.
Yeah, let's tackle that step by step. So first of all, the dominion question. In actual fact, Canada technically still is a dominion. Dominion, as I understand, actually did apply to other former colonies that were self-governed, whether it would be Newfoundland or whether it would have been New Zealand and other territories. And basically was used to identify a collection, in many cases of former colonies, as was the case in Canada, as one overarching entity that was self-governed vis-a-vis the Crown. But in actual fact, this is a side point, Canada was originally meant to be called the Kingdom of Canada.
Really?
Quite. And your history is correct. If we go back to 1867, which is the date of Confederation, when Canada basically became Canada as a country, originally the aim was that it would be called the Kingdom, but there was a fear that calling it the Dominion would somehow, or I should say rather, they called it the Kingdom, would somehow cause some issues with the United States. And so the decision was to actually call it a Dominion. So that's a little bit of the history there. Now, how have we, or why have we stayed loyal? I would argue, a lot of reasons for that. Starting point, very simply, if we go back in history, the Canadians listening will probably identify that many of the individuals, certainly in English Canada, who settled in what was at that time Upper Canada, a colony, were loyalists. We still talk of the Loyalist Parkway. These were individuals who fled what became the United States because of their loyalty to the Crown. So your starting point already is one where there is identification. Now, then you have a second issue, which is, well, our structures, our governmental structures are fundamentally intertwined with the Crown. And this question was asked quite a bit in Canada over the past few weeks. And, you know, a lot of the sentiment was, well, if it ain't fixed, you know, if it ain't broken, why, what's there to fix? You know, the system does work. Not only so, but some of the elements in that relationship are fundamental in how we as a nation operate. I come back to First Nations, and it's a very timely point because just a few days ago would have been the Truth and Reconciliation Day in Canada. It's a national holiday. We talk about a day where we think back and to very recent times, unfortunately, of the treatment of our First Nations. Residential schools, we're familiar with this. Now, it is also the case that our First Nations have a direct relationship with the Crown. Their treaties are not with the government of Canada. So fundamentally and institutionally, the Crown remains a fundamental part of our fabric. And then lastly, one could also argue that perhaps less so, but certainly now I speak personally growing up, being part of the Commonwealth and having the Queen as our head of state was a way to differentiate vis-a-vis our friends to the South. It was just part of our identity. And in many ways, we would look to our neighbor to the South, and at least again, from a personal standpoint, self-identify in many ways, say, why are we different? So this was quite key. Now, we can then speak of that as a generalization. You asked the question about, you know, how does this stand across the country? It's interesting. Yeah. Well, one could argue that if you look at the overall numbers in Canada, again, I'm citing the same poll I mentioned earlier, what you can see is that, roughly speaking, about 1 in 5 Canadians will identify with a strong attachment to the monarchy. Okay, today. you will then see that if you look to the east of the country, that number is roughly 1 in 4. If you go to Quebec, you divide that in half. Okay. So there is perhaps less identification in Quebec. In fact, even when now, with her passing, there was even something of a controversy where members of the Parti Québécois, which is a separatist party in Quebec, did actually criticize that the flag was at half-mast upon her passing. So one can say that it's difficult to differ, you know, to let's say generalize across Canada, but clearly the relationship has been more ambivalent with Quebec.
Good. It's a good answer, but it's important because it is a long history and it's a complicated history. Today I'm talking about the reign of the late Queen Elizabeth II and what she meant to my guest, Michael Type, at whose home we are, Professor David Friedman, Norman Williams, and Sanjay Acharya. They offer the British, Canadian, Jamaican, and Indian perspectives. Norman, I'm going to turn to you now with a question again, which probably won't surprise you, but I declare an interest, you know, having been born in Jamaica and married to a Jamaican. Recently, as you know, William and Kate, then the Duchess, Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, now the Prince and Princess of Wales, toured Jamaica and some of the other English-speaking islands. The Jamaican leg of the tour was described by many in the British media as a disaster. Strong words indeed, and rather an embarrassment for those of us like my wife and myself who hold Jamaica dear. We won't discuss the tours, neither you nor I were there, but tell us about a Republican sentiment in Jamaica. How real is it? And why it has taken so long? After all, Guyana, Trinidad and Tobago and Barbados have already done it. I mean, how, in your opinion, do modern-day Jamaicans view the UK and the British monarchy?
So it's a complicated thing. Let's first get back to the tour. I don't know much about it, just as you said, but I would suspect that Kate and William are seen as stiff and maybe slightly bratty as well, so it wouldn't go well. Plus, I think there was always a truce in Jamaica that nothing would be done as long as the Queen is there. And it's more of a fair game after the Queen goes. Because Charles was never well-liked either, even though Harry said that his father told him that Jamaica was his favorite destination to visit. It's very strange. All Jamaica was, like, surprised by that. But anyway, I think the Republican sentiment is growing. Both political parties are pushing for it. The younger people are more ambivalent or maybe for it. The older people are not. I think the basis of that split comes from the fact that there was an extreme euphoria in Jamaica after 1962 independence that did not materialize the way people are. A lot of people are disappointed. So change is seen as, you know, doubling down on the people who did not deliver. So there's a lot of resistance to that, even among some younger people. But that has to be tempered by the fact that Charles is not the most popular guy. And if the Queen Elizabeth could live till 200 years old, maybe Jamaica would continue for another 50 years as a not a dominion, but an independent monarchy. Okay. This is how is it seen in Jamaica. But now I think within the next 2 years, it's going to go to a vote, and they're probably going to try to ram it through.
Okay. Well, right? Thanks for that perspective. Now, we can't have a conversation about the late Queen without addressing the Commonwealth. That's 56 nations. Its origin came out of the empire, as most people know. Now it even has states with no historical connection with Great Britain, like Mozambique, Rwanda, Gabon, Togo. Let me start with you, Sanjay. What is your view of the Commonwealth? How do you see its use? I mean, how is it perceived?
It's a difficult question, really, from our perspective in India. But we have had a lot of... we give the Commonwealth a great deal of support, I think, because it does bring some like-minded people together, even if they, you know, they've had some connections with Britain and so forth. And I think that's what keeps that... You know, it's a cement that keeps it together. And we always find some gain or benefit in clubbing together with other countries, anything that sort of comes together where we are able to achieve some of our personal goals and our national interests as well. That's always that governs any such meeting with governments.
That's fair enough. And Norman, how do you see how do you see it, and how do you think Jamaicans see the Commonwealth?
Jamaicans, in general, love the Commonwealth. But one freebie is that you have the Commonwealth Games, which Jamaica does well at.
In sprinting,
but also netball.
In netball
is the highest pinnacle in netball is the Commonwealth Games.
Of course.
And
the
five or six biggies are always vying for top billing there. But I see the Commonwealth, and Jamaicans, I think, see the Commonwealth as a group of well-behaving friends. Don't forget, Nigeria was suspended for a few years when they had a brutal dictator. We also have a common fabric of governance structures and sometimes even financial system. Jamaica has a Canadian financial system. Most people don't realize that. So there is some commonality. We do cooperate well within the Commonwealth. Cricket is also, except for Canada and a few others,
there's still time.
Binding
there's
element.
Still time for Canada.
It's a binding element for the Commonwealth as well, too. And it's a way for Britain to still stay relevant. And English is also a dominating factor there, too, because Mozambique is there because they're surrounded by English-speaking neighbors. And some other countries, I think, join because they like the stability and the camaraderie they see in the Commonwealth.
David, tell us, how does Canada see the Commonwealth?
Well, I think very much, you know, picking up on some of the comments that you made, Norman, I mean, it's a set of countries where there's some shared values. And I think that we see that as something which is a different way for us to also exercise our soft power, as well as to be able to engage and share. And we have the benefit in Canada of doing that across the Commonwealth, but also the Francophonie, as we're members of both. I think the question moving forward is, you know, what, speaking from a personal standpoint, you know, what will the role of the Commonwealth be? And picking up from what you were saying, Michael, if some of the countries, I think New Zealand did flag some indication that they would look to become a republic, as an example, Australia perhaps as well. What next? What happens? And what becomes that new shared value? So I think, you know, to be written. But as an overall element, it may not be top of mind in Canada. I mean, if we look at our trading partners, for example, you know, our trade is, to be fair, mostly with the folks to the south. But nonetheless, it still remains a part of who we are. And yes, the Commonwealth Games are always an opportunity for us to not have to compete against the Americans, which is always good. So,
I thought most of the Canadian track team was from Jamaica anyway, but that's another story. Michael, we're at your home. We're going to give you the last word. You're also the Briton. I'm also British, but you know, you've got blonde hair and blue eyes. You know. But tell us, what does the Commonwealth mean to you, Michael Tyne?
An enormous amount. Having travelled around many of those countries, what always astonishes me is that it hangs together. And you've mentioned several countries which have had no British link whatsoever. But may I just say a couple of things which I feel about the Queen. Firstly, I mentioned the troubles in Northern Ireland earlier on. But what we must not forget is that she helped bring those troubles to an end by going to the Republic of Ireland, being certainly at the invitation of the Prime Minister and the President, but it created an enormous amount of goodwill. And then one of a human nature, she started the walkabout. The monarchy over centuries was a very remote institution. She started the walkabout, going around shaking hands with people, whether in the United Kingdom or in various Commonwealth countries. And for me, she has represented continuity and an ability to be modest, and with one perhaps exception in the case of Diana, a modesty and a sense of duty.
Thank you. Well, thank you, all of you, for your fascinating insights. As for me, I've learned a lot just listening to you over the last 25, that the clock is going there, 28 minutes. I've enjoyed it. I hope you have too. And my guests today have been Michael Tyne, Professor David Friedman, Sanjay Arachaya, and Norman Williams. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.